This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. We've seen the headlines, maid starved to death, maid tortured and sexually assaulted by employers. Abused maid recounts 8 months in torture chamber. Even if domestic workers aren't physically abused by their employers, many of their lives resemble that of a modern day slave. Unfair wages, no days off, no telephones, having their passports withheld and so on. Joining me now to discuss the troubling issue of domestic worker abuse and how we should address this issue are Ajil Fernandez and Katrina Maliamau from Tanaganita, a grassroots organization that has been working on protecting and promoting the rights of women, migrants and refugees since 1991. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How would you describe the attitudes held by Malaysians when it comes to migrant domestic workers?
I think if you look, Malaysians will never address them as domestic workers. And even in the law itself, they are seen as servants. So the whole attitude is that you are a servant, therefore you are, you know, I am the master and you are the servant, you do what I tell you to do. And I think with that mentality, and it is not something new, because we look back, even way back from the 70s when we had our own local domestic workers, it was the same when we were handling cases. It was like, you are not educated, you are there, you just do what I tell you to do. I pay you what I think I should pay you, and then you go, you know, and you don't cause trouble. So it's like, I keep you under my control.
I think in addition to what Ajil said, there is a sense among most Malaysians, increasingly perhaps, that yes, there are cases of violence, there are cases where employers treat their domestic workers terribly, but by and large, we're all right. As a country, we treat our domestic workers well, although we don't call them workers, we call them maids, we call them servants or helpers, anything that doesn't capture that they are in fact workers in their home. And the problem with that is that we, by and large, have a sense of normalized violence in our homes. And we say normalized violence because I think the measures for what bad treatment towards domestic workers are often is just along the lines of physical violence, you know, explicit violence, you know, starvation. So not even poor food intake, but starvation, sexual violence. And yes, all these terrible things do happen, but there are a quieter, more invisible ways also in which we take away one's dignity, we silence one's humanity, we abuse. You mentioned in your introduction the holding of passports, and the holding of passports is important because holding of passports means controlling of your freedom of movement, your inability to leave the home. Even if it's not just for escape, but to make choices as an adult, not being able to use your telephone, unless it's without the explicit permission of your employer. So that means that not only can you not call for safety, but also you can't keep in touch with your family, your friends, you can't maintain social networks. I mean, these are all very, very basic things that we as people take for granted that we need in our lives. But when it comes to migrants, when it comes to domestic workers, we seem to view them as being less than human, even if we don't say that, even if our language doesn't capture that, our behavior certainly does. But all of this remains invisible. And so the attitudes, therefore, are one where, you know, actually Malaysians are treat their domestic workers fine. But the reality of the cases and Ajil's experience over the last 3 decades shows otherwise.
What are the factors that contribute to the abuse of migrant domestic workers by their employers? I mean, certainly this ownership mentality, this normalization of, less than optimal treatment, I guess, these are part of it. What other key factors have you identified?
I think one is that we do not have a concrete legislation to protect them in here. And also, if you do have other laws that we say that protects them, but we do not enforce that law. And you speak to many of, even to the domestic workers or to NGOs and others, they will tell you that authorities or the state would cite the employer rather than the domestic worker or the employee. And that's the way we work in this country today, you see. So it all derives from the fact that you want your economy to go. You want to give, in terms of support system for employers, you know, that when the write-up in the papers came about to say, oh, 35,000 households are now looking for domestic workers, but not about how they are treated, what should be given to them.
Carrying on Adel's point about the laws, I think the legislative framework certainly has a huge role to play, right, in terms of how it shapes attitudes and behaviours towards workers, towards domestic workers. And so, yes, in Malaysia, I mean, there was a study done in 2010 with Tenaganita and a few other organisations on employers' perceptions towards domestic workers. And in Malaysia, it found that 68% of the employers surveyed found that we had sufficient laws to protect domestic workers' rights.
Well, no, on that note, I was just going to ask, well, what are the laws? If we don't have a sufficient legislative framework, I mean, what do we have right now?
We have the Employment Act, but the Employment Act for domestic workers only states in terms of wages. So you can negotiate for wages at the Labour Department. Okay, we have, if there's severe abuse, then they use the Penal Code, which is for everyone. Now, we have the ATIPSM, Anti-Trafficking in Persons and Smuggling of Migrants Act, but that is hardly used in terms of for domestic workers, because in a large number of cases that we take up to the relevant authorities, they are not identified as trafficked victims. And that is the main problem, you know. And even if you take, we have the Passport Act, which clearly is out there, but when we go and file a police report to get back that passport, the authorities will say, oh, you know, you just go and negotiate and try and get. But they will not assist you. So I think these are major problems that contributes to it.
And we've been talking about the word servant. Does the recognition of domestic workers under the servant category in deployment in the Employment Act 1955 also affect their rights? Because, you know, they're, as you rightly point out, not recognised as workers as such.
Certainly, yes. I mean, I think the definition of them not as workers excludes them from a lot of the different provisions under the Employment Act. We have a very piecemeal and incredibly insufficient approach to legislative approach to domestic workers. So what Tenaganita has been calling for is a comprehensive policy on domestic workers, following the trend of countries. Brazil, I think, recently passed a Domestic Workers Act, because it needs to take into account the peculiarities of domestic work. So right now it remains invisible, it remains in the home, it remains unregulated. The word servant also is really important in, I think, shaping our consciousness around how we see domestic workers. So once more, we don't see them as workers, we see them as servants, and that reinforces the master-servant relationship, and the hierarchy then of us owning them, owning their time, really feeds into the mentality. But I mean, getting to your earlier question about what are the root causes, in addition to, I think, legislation, it's really, really important for us to think about the culture in the country, and for us to interrogate what our beliefs and values are. So when we look at just housework itself, right? Housework is a very gendered form of work, and it's our, I think, that call for us to interrogate our beliefs about gender roles, how we don't value women's work, and we see domestic work as being women's work. We also have to think about our attitudes towards migrants, our sense of ownership towards migrants. That certainly shapes the behaviour of employers, where we think we've paid for their labour, and it's just their labour that we want. We don't want any other expressions of their personhood.
I think looking at the last, you know, 33 years in dealing with our domestic workers, I think we have now become worst off. The violence is worst off. Well, look back in the 80s when the first Filipina domestic workers came. It was about cheating. It was just keeping them locked up, you know, and you get a little bit of physical abuse. But today, and I think as rightfully Katrina pointed out, the whole violence attitude that is prevalent in our society today, you know, and there is no check and balance on that. And this is, again, a private home. So I can do what I want in my private home and nobody should come in or nobody should bother about it, you know. And we have allowed that to grow. You know, we have allowed. Even you take neighbors by your side who know about what is happening. But how many would come forward to say, no, she needs that protection. She needs. But you will say, no, I don't want to do that because that's my neighbor. And I don't want ill feelings, you know, with my neighbor. So I think it is important, therefore, that we rethink the whole question of how we abuse people as generally.
I'm speaking today with Angel Fernandez and Katrina Maliamau from Tenaganita. We're talking about the abuse of domestic workers in Malaysia. Up next, we discuss a little more explicitly what dimensions that abuse takes. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and my guests today are Angel Fernandez and Katrina Maliamau from Tenaganita. We're discussing the abuse of domestic workers here in Malaysia. Now, according to the Global Slavery Index 2016, over 128,000 workers in Malaysia are employed in slave-like conditions and treated like livestock. How accurate is this statistic based on your work and research?
I think that the patterns of violence that we see, the lack of protection mechanisms in the country, the culture of impunity towards violence when it comes to migrants, like all of these factors feed into this the normalization of forced labor and slavery. And so the statistics that may seem alarming really do reflect the cases that we get. I think it's important to note also that the cases that we get are a very, very small number in relation to the hundreds of thousands of domestic workers, tens of thousands in Malaysian homes. I mean, these are women who have been able to escape, who've been able to find us, and are trying to seek some form of redress. Majority remain hidden in homes and entrapped in those circumstances.
Yeah, I would say I think it's a very low figure. Yeah. If from experiences of Tenaganita being on the ground, and we're looking at not just Peninsular Malaysia, we're looking at Sabah and Sarawak, and there's huge abuse of domestic workers in these two states too, which is not addressed, you know. And if you ask in terms of how many abused domestic workers are statistically in government departments, it will show you very small number. Because the whole idea is you don't want abusers to be recorded into your statistics, because that will show. But leaving aside Malaysia, you cannot run out from the fact that they're abusers, because it goes back to the sending countries. And sending countries have high records of the women being abused. And that is why we see that countries like the Philippines today, like Indonesia, Cambodia, don't want to send the women here, because you are sending back shattered women.
Slavery and slaves, I mean, those are two words that people find very hard to stomach. You know, they're words that people don't like to apply. But given the conditions that many domestic workers are subject to, would you say they are treated as slaves?
I think if you think about what makes conditions of slavery, being trapped, the kinds of violence, denied your wages, the sense of ownership by your employer, all of these elements definitely feed into the ideas of slavery. I think the visuals in most of our minds when we talk about slavery are historical images of the transatlantic slave trade, for example. So we have visuals of people in shackles, and those are powerful images, but I think we need to update it to our current context, where we have women foreign women, often in homes that may look very nice, in neighbourhoods that are in gated communities. And it all seems very innocent and innocuous. But this is the challenge then to us, first to really interrogate what violence means, the conceptions of it, and what there's so much that we've chosen to ignore. We make excuses. We say that we are the ones who are being threatened if we recognize somebody else's rights. So all of that, I think, are certainly elements that have fed and led us to keep perpetuating the cycle of violence. You know, Ajal mentioned earlier that she feels like it's getting worse. And I think these are, if we think about the bigger picture, these are the hard questions that we need to ask ourselves. What are the cycles of violence that we're reproducing in our own homes because of the ways in which we treat people and then we make excuses for that behaviour?
We mentioned earlier that abuse, just like slavery, we need to update our notion of what abuse means. You know, abuse doesn't necessarily mean the huge headlines that hit the news, but also smaller, subtler things. What would constitute abuse?
One, of course, which we mentioned earlier was the withholding of passports. That is definitely an abuse. You as a Malaysian, you don't want someone else to hold your passport or ID. You know, but it does not apply to someone who works for you, right? The simple fact, too, that when you have someone in your house and you make them sit in the kitchen and eat out of plates that's only given to them or sleep in a storeroom, right? That's abuse. And these are things that we don't see. Giving someone 2 packets of Maggie Mee to eat for a day, that's abuse, just 2 days. And you sign a contract to say that you would give them enough, good accommodation and enough adequate food, you know? And therefore, what constitutes? So all these little things, you restrict the movement. You don't allow them to get out. You don't give them a day off. These are all abuses which we don't see it, but we think that it is severe physical abuse or if there's a sexual abuse, right? But even in sexual abuse, you look at sexual harassment. Out there, there's a lot of sexual harassment that goes on in a household as a domestic worker, but they don't have the avenue to go and get the grievances met.
I mean, in addition to that, I think we can name lots and lots of examples. Unfortunately, we can from our experiences. But I think it's what we need to urge ourselves to understand is when we talk about violence, is physical violence, is sexual violence, psychological and emotional violence, and economic violence. Our understanding of rights must be, the basic understanding of rights is that rights are inherent in all of us. So if we are born, if we exist on this planet, we exist with human rights. Our human rights also are all interconnected. So why are we saying that it's really important for people to have their right to hold their passport? The right to hold your passport is connected to your freedom of movement, your access to justice, your ability to form social networks and relationships. The right to privacy is so closely tied to also the threat of sexual harassment and violence, for example, or mental well-being. I mean, it doesn't even have to go to the point of outward violence, but think about our lives and how we often need spaces to be quiet, to think, to do things that give us joy. All of this, like stripping away these different elements that make us human, that make us healthy, that let us enjoy our dignity, all of that constitutes various forms of violence. And this is the challenge, right? Because these are the cases and experiences that are hard to record. Perhaps even if our current legislative frameworks, our authorities, enforcement agencies, don't have the means to capture what do these cases, when these cases do exist. But also in our own imagination, we have to understand that what we expect for ourselves, we need to expect for migrants too. Because once we start making excuses for somebody else's rights not to be protected, we kind of lose our own claim to rights. Because rights are, the enjoyment of rights needs to be for all.
With several high-profile cases, such as that of Indonesian maid Kunarse, who was found dead in 2007, Nirmala Bonat, who was physically abused by her employer in 2010, one would think that this problem would hopefully be a little further along towards being solved. Why do these cases persist, even though these headlines have been made, even though abusive employers are prosecuted by the law? You would think that having an example, you know, would kind of set some sort of precedent.
I think, for starters, the law works not consistently, and that's a problem, right? So many employees get away with it. They deport away the problem. And the problem here is the domestic worker who's trying to seek justice. But the law in itself isn't enough to change. We have to understand that the culture, our common practices, all of that matters too. And so while we absolutely must have adequate and strong legislative frameworks, good access to justice for all, for domestic workers. And access to justice here also means removing the barriers, so allowing her to remain in the country and work, making sure that she knows her rights, that she has a lawyer, that the court processes are in a language that she can understand. All of that's important, but there is also that internal process that we need to go through as Malaysians. As Ajil talked earlier about the cycle of violence, right? We're not going to change this unless we as Malaysians, we as employers, we as neighbours and friends of people who have domestic workers choose to engage back with our humanity. Because there must be a process where we disengage from these common values and principles that respect people's lives.
How do we cope with the fact that these abuses take place in private households? I mean, Ajil, you mentioned that earlier, that ultimately that seems to be, you know, the basic covering statement, that sort of umbrella statement. Well, it happens at home. How do we protect people when they are in the private homes of others?
One of the things I think to all those who are listening in and to all those who would listen later, I think we need to ask a very basic question of why do we abuse another person? I think that is the question that each one of ourselves we need to ask. What does it give me by abusing another human being like me? You know, and that is the second is, I think we need to not look this anymore. You are hiring someone to work for you. You're no more private. The moment you pay, you want to pay someone, it doesn't become private. And therefore, that particular household, you must be given the authority to monitor, to see what is going on. And that is done by authorities and as a community. And that is very relevant. Also, the very fact, I think, we don't give enough right for a migrant worker or a domestic worker to access that right of I can file a complaint, right? I am not happy working in this condition that I can leave. So what I mean to say is we can have laws. We can have beautiful laws. And I think Malaysia has too many laws. But it's all about, I think, how do we, as a person, as a Malaysian, that I want to do something that is right, that is good. You know, and that starts from within your own family unit itself, to educate your own family unit and the community. And if we can just do that, I start with my own home, and then I start by looking at my community, the households around me. It's enough for us to make changes.
How can we monitor and prevent these cases of abuse before they happen? Because unfortunately, we always talk about it after the fact, you know. And Katrina, as you pointed out, it's a small percentage of people who manage to A, get out of the home, B, find you, and C, you know, kind of work things through in that way. The ideal situation would be to not have these women even have to escape at all, I suppose. So how can these situations be monitored in that sense?
I mean, it begins by us understanding that the reason the violence, the forced labour, the enslavement, the bonded forms of work, domestic workers are in, happens because our systems and our structures are seemingly wired for exploitation, right? And so if we understand that, then we have to say, okay, so what are the fundamental changes we need to make in our system? I mean, having the law is one thing, ensuring that there is a contract and that the terms of employment are clear and agreed upon by the domestic workers. She must understand the terms of a contract. It is not sufficient to just have a contract exist in the hands of government agencies and employment agencies with the employer. She must also have the freedom to move. And that comes, very closely with her ability to hold a passport, and I think the other part that I really want to make note of is that when we talk about how change should happen, it's really important that domestic workers, the people whose rights we're talking about, be part of this discussion. They must feed into the agenda for change. And that actually is quite a fundamental concept of access to justice, that access to justice begins not just after something terrible has happened, but in the conception of laws and the administration and the interpretation of it. So we have to create these spaces to include domestic workers in the conversation. Right now, that's an incredible struggle that we have because we can barely connect to them. They remain in homes, and we can't organize. They cannot organize themselves, let alone provide input and feedback into the kind of change that needs to happen. So lots of different steps, but I think this is only going to be addressed meaningfully if we take clear notice that it's systematic and it's so deeply embedded in the structures. And that's why we need to dismantle, and then we need to build differently.
Yeah, and I just want to include is that if only they are given a day off, they can then access justice. They can know their rights, and they know their rights, but they can't go anywhere. So that right to a day off and the right to move, I think you would have more than double the amount of issues and cases that we have.
I mean, additionally, also, I think it's super important for us to realize, sometimes we get this criticism, Tanaganita, why don't you tell the government? why don't you suggest? And we've had numerous consultations. We've put together comprehensive proposals. We've worked on it. We're working on a draft bill. The information is there. The International Labour Organization 5 years ago passed Convention 189 on domestic workers. Okay. There are many countries we can look to for good examples in terms of how they've started to make fundamental changes to the system. So we're no longer at that point where this is not stage one of the process of change. This is decades of work, of trying to make change happen. But the state has thus far ignored us. The state's response has been to move from one country to the next, seeking populations that are the most vulnerable, that can, who are desperate for remittances and therefore desperate to send their migrants abroad. And I say this because when Filipinos started organizing to have better conditions for their workers, we moved to Indonesia. When Indonesians started organizing, we moved to Cambodia. And then we've tried now moving to Timor-Leste. And so this, I just wanted to be clear that these proposals and suggestions and recommendations we're making are not new. The government agencies at all levels know them and understand them. And I think for Malaysians, we have to understand that while we call our state to take action, we cannot also disengage from our own obligation to holding the state accountable. So we must hold the feet of our government officials to the fire. But that can only come if we have fire in our consciousness, wanting there to be change.
As you rightly point out, we seem to just kind of hop around from country to country whenever we realize, oh, this isn't quite working out anymore, rather than perhaps looking at ourselves and thinking, well, why doesn't anyone want to play with us anymore in that sense? And with so many parties involved in the hiring process, from government, private agencies to employers, how do we protect workers at each level, which we don't appear to be doing in our travels around Southeast Asia, looking for, more importation of domestic foreign workers?
One is, I think, we must have uniformity in domestic workers. We now, even in the way we look at it, we look from country to country. We look when a country, one country, pushes and says, no, my nationals must be protected and, you know, and the whole withdrawal takes place. Then you try to say, okay, they are more educated so that we pay them differently as compared to someone who comes from another country because they are not pushing for, you know, change. They just want the nationals to go out and work, right? Now, that's why we say domestic work is work all round is equal. So we are saying that you now should have a standardized contract with a standardized salary for all who work in that field. And that would then again be something that you do not go country by country. Now you look, we have ASEAN. We have a whole ASEAN chapter on human rights. We want to look. But yet again, it is just signing of agreements. It is discussions at meetings. You go back and that's it. Nothing else takes place. You know? And therefore, when there is this way of working, then of course you allow that space for abuses to continue. And employers will tell you and agents will tell you, you can go and file. Nothing is going to happen to us. That woman is going to be deported. That woman is going to get out. Or that woman is going to be arrested and put into the detention center. So this is what the response, because we have allowed that to continue.
I mean, they also ought to be coherent and consistent understanding of human rights throughout government agencies, throughout our policies. And I say this feeling like I think a lot of people will consider me to be very naive and idealistic. But human rights are not idealistic. They shouldn't be aspirational. They are basic. They are fundamental. And I think it is really important that we don't make excuses and that we continue to demand that the kinds of actions that we take, the kinds of policies that we enact, the decisions that we make must be rooted in principles of human rights. And Malaysia has more than enough to look to for guidance. There are more than enough agencies that are willing to work with the government at all different levels. And I'm unwilling to make excuses for anyone in that regard.
Thank you both very much for coming in today. I've been speaking with Asiel Fernandez and Katrina Maliamau, both from Tenaganita, and we've been discussing the abuse of domestic workers here in Malaysia and what needs to be done to stop it. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.